This is Beyond Busy. I'm Graham Alcott. I'm the author of a number of books, including the global bestseller How to Be a Productivity Ninja, and I'm the founder of Think Productive. We work with some of the world's leading companies to help people get stuff done, but more importantly, to help people to make space for what matters. Beyond Busy is where I explore the often messy truths and contradictory relationships around topics like work-life balance, happiness and success, and explore with interesting people what makes them tick. In short, this is where we ask the bigger questions about work. My guests today are David Bradford and Carol Robin. They are the authors of the book Connect, Building Exceptional Relationships with Family, Friends and Colleagues. David and Carol are the course founders for Stanford's most popular and legendary MBA elective course, Interpersonal Dynamics, affectionately known as the Touchy-Feely course. And they have a combined 75 years of teaching experience helping some of the world's leading business people develop their EQ as well as their IQ. In this episode, we talk about how you can do all this touchy-feely stuff better and how it impacts leadership, relationships, and business success. This is David Bradford and Carol Robin. So I'm with David Bradford and Carol Robin. How are you both doing? I was going to say this afternoon, but for you, it's this morning because you're over on the west coast of the States. Yes. How are you doing?
Early.
Early, yeah. We're waking up. Still have my coffee.
So you're having your first morning coffee of the day. I'm having about my 15th afternoon tea. So there we go. So welcome to Beyond Busy. It's lovely having you on the show. And we're going to talk a little bit about your book, which is called Connect. And before we get into that, the book is based on a really legendary program you both set up at Stanford. And I just wanted to get into that. So you're both course leaders on the Touchy-Feely course. So should we just start with that? What is the Touchy-Feely course, first of all?
Well, this is a course that has been at the School of Business for over 50 years and started off very small and now is the biggest elective and most popular elective. It's a course in which students work in small groups and learn about how they relate to each other by relating to each other and getting feedback from their peers. So it's a very powerful course where people start to hear, this is how you come across to me. This is what you do that makes me close to you. This is what you do which puts me off a bit. And they learn how to do that not in a brutal way, but in a caring way.
Nice.
And I'll add that I think the reason the course has had so much impact and become so legendary is that it turns out to be life-changing. That's how students and alums refer to it, life-changing. And thousands of them over decades describe it that way because of the impact it has on them both personally and professionally.
Yeah. And I did some reading about the course and there's quite a large component of it, which is basically a blank page, right? So you put people in groups and it's up to them to come up with the content. It's up to them to come up with the schedule around it. So whose idea was that? And tell me a bit more about how that works.
Well, it actually started about 80 years ago in a program in Connecticut, right after World War II, where they were training community leaders to open up housing for African Americans in the North. And so they were doing training, but they were also doing research on group behavior, group dynamics. And the staff would meet in the evening and plan for the next day. It's called action research, the way you do it. And one day, three of the participants walked into the staff room. And one of the leaders had been very active in democratic leadership and felt he couldn't ask them to leave. The next evening, all the participants walked in. The graduate students who were doing research on the groups continued. And one student said, at 10:30 this morning, Mary Jones made a comment that stopped the progress of the group. But Mary Jones was there. And she said, no, I didn't. And another participant said, yes, you did. I was bothered about that. And what the staff realized was this was more real than any discussions or role that they had. So like Fleming, who discovered penicillin by accident, they discovered this process by accident. And what we do is we try and get the students, again, with caring, not with meanness, share their reaction. Because as a friend of ours said, it takes two to know one. I need you to know me. I know my intention, but you know the effect of my behavior. Hmm. And can build conditions where I learn the effect of my behavior.
Nice. So this program is vastly oversubscribed. So I think I read something that said like 85% of people who do a Stanford MBA are all trying to get on this course. So what's the criteria that are set out to for somebody to actually win a place on the course in the first place?
Oh, we don't.
You don't know.
We fortunately did not determine that.
Okay.
There's a whole process through which students bid for classes, particularly what's called high demand classes, and it's a bit of a lottery, frankly, and actually it's not a bit; it is a lottery. And what we do have is we have what we call a pre-qualification that students need to fill out before they can bid for the class or enter the lottery. And in that, we just want to make sure that they understand that this is a very different kind of class, one in which they will be, I mean, they're pushed in every class and challenged in every class, but they're going to be challenged emotionally in this one. And we want to make sure they, you know, because the class has so much lore and there's so much myth around it, we want students to take it because it's the right fit for them right now. Yeah. If they've just had a big trauma in their life and they're starting a business and they're taking 20 units and they're already stretched way thinner than they can handle, maybe it's not the best time to take this class.
Yeah. So, like the name of the class, the touchy-feely class, obviously that has a sort of tongue-in-cheek, you know, kind of humorous element to it. But do you feel like there's something sad about the fact that the kind of skills that you're teaching on this class, so you're helping people to give feedback to each other, to communicate, to relate to people personally, so that is still sort of seen as a bit of an add-on in business, isn't it? Rather than, you know, as it should be, I think, anyway, and I'm sure you agree, it's so central and fundamental to how you set up teams, how you set up businesses. So do you think it's sad in a way that the name hasn't changed after so long? And do you think it's still seen that way?
I didn't know. I think there has been a real change. As I've seen it over the decades, people would raise the question. Sometimes even our colleagues would raise the question, why is this taught in school of business and not in a psych department or a social department?
Oh, wow. Okay.
I think the world really is changing. And I think Goleman's book, Emotional Intelligence, helped it. But I think we also realize that we just aren't turning out widgets. You know, we need each other in organizations.
Yes.
So the manager who says, I don't care about people, I just want to get the product out the door, that's not a company I'm going to invest in.
Yeah.
And I think that there's more and more realization of that.
Yeah. And David, just before we started recording, you said to me that a lot of participants on the course will experience really dramatic changes in their life. So as well as this being something that really aids their ability in business, they're also going home and having much more in-depth conversations with their spouse or with their child or with their parent, and it's really changing some of those personal relationships. So do you want to talk a little bit about that, like why is that happening, and you know, have you got some examples of really big changes that have happened as a result?
I think that what students learn which we find so gratifying and so exciting is, particularly in a school of business, but I think elsewhere, people walk around putting on an image, and they have the notion that if I'm to be interesting, leader-like, sexy, whatever you want, I have to pretend to be something that I'm not. And what they discover in this course, almost inevitably, is that the more they are themselves, the more interesting they are, the more attractive they are. And we frequently have students halfway through the course say to another one, Bill, you know, I thought in finance you were really obnoxious, but now that I see you, I see that you're human. Mm. I really like you. So where this translates is that they learn that they not only learn that they can be themselves, but they learn how to be themselves. They take this elsewhere. So I had a relatively mature student in his 40s, as we have some students who are that old, who told me afterwards, he said, I went home after this course and I said to my teenage daughter, you know, I realized I probably never really listened to you. Wow. And she said, that's right. I never feel listened to. And he said, that was the most profound, satisfying conversation we had. It changed that relationship. Wow. So people learn, how can I tell you what's important to me? How can I let you know my concerns, my worries, my hopes, my dreams, without having to put a spin on it? Yeah. And that applies to all relationships. Now, we're not saying that you go in and you self-disclose everything. We don't need that. But people learn to say, this is what I need to share with you in this relationship so that you know me, the real me, not the presented me.
Yeah. And
if I might, I have some wonderful examples of this as well.
And if I might, I'd like to go back to the name. So the name of the course is actually Interpersonal Dynamics. The school doesn't call it touchy-feely.
Right.
Just the thousands of students who take it call it touchy-feely. Part of the reason I feel the need to say that is that if you just Google touchy-feely, you'll get a lot of weird things. And I think there's something interesting about the fact that the students, they don't have cute names for any of their other courses, right? All the other courses are called entrepreneurship or corporate finance, right? Only touchy-feely has its own little weird name. And I think that's one of the interesting, there's something to that because they make it their own in a way that they might not make some of their other classes, because what they learn is that how they show up, who they are in these groups is what determines how much they learn. Yeah. If I don't say much about myself, then I don't get much feedback from you. Then I don't learn anything about myself. The other thing that I'll say is that fundamental, you know, back to where David started, you know, people do business with people.
Yeah.
They don't do business with ideas or machines or money. And so that's why this course has become so legendary. And that's why we wrote the book, because we didn't want just Stanford students to have this knowledge and these competencies.
So the book is called Connect. One question before we get into the book though, Carol, which is, so you have taking a lot of these ideas and now run Leaders in Tech to take this into the tech world. So just interested in how you see Silicon Valley right now in terms of, obviously the tech world is, you know, there's often this, you know, kind of image of people in tech as always being very geeky and very closed off and they don't want to communicate. Like, have you seen an evolution there? Like, do you feel like a lot of those organizations are much more focused on culture than they used to be and the skills of managers and leaders?
I think it's shifting. I think that a lot of organizations in the Valley are starting to see that these are things they should have paid attention to way at the beginning, which is why Leaders in Tech has been very successful, because we positioned ourselves to work with founder CEOs of early startups. They have to have raised what we call an A round, but they have to be pre-IPO. Okay. So not necessarily the Facebooks and the Googles of the world, although we'd love to work with them eventually. But we started because what we heard was a hunger by these CEO founders to establish initial conditions in their organizations that would value relationship and that would build cultures that would be much more inclusive and diverse. And we've had 1,200 people apply to the program and accepted 120. So our we've had, you know, pretty good success, I'd say. And we've scaled slowly and plan to continue to do that. Now it's, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I'm not going to say that the whole valley has finally found the light. There are still a lot of companies in the valley, and a lot of tech leaders who believe that the only thing that matters is the product. And you're not going to have a great successful business without a great product. That's true. But you're not going to have a sustainable long-term business without paying attention to the people. You might come up with a fantastic product, right time, right place, make a ton of money, retire to Tahiti. I'm not going to deny that. But if what matters, and that's what I find my leaders in tech founders care about, is they're very mission-driven. They're trying to build products that will actually make a difference in the world, but they want to build a company that they'll be proud to say they built.
Yeah. So the book is called Connect, Building Exceptional Relationships with Friends, Family, and Colleagues. So it sounds like the aim of the book and the vision for the book when you started was trying to distill all the best bits from the course into a book. Is that pretty much a good summary?
Yeah. In essence, we were seeing, as Carol said, the impact on the students. And the dream we have, I think that the vision we have is, could we somehow have the reader have the same or a similar experience so that they too are transformed to some degree? So we want to impact the world, to be honest.
Right. Thousands of MBAs and a few hundred leaders in Silicon Valley is not enough.
Got to keep going. So the book starts with this idea of the six hallmarks of successful relationships. So I'm interested to hear what those six hallmarks are. Should we start with that first of all?
Sure. First, I think I want to just change the one word. Except we use the word exceptional, but the six hallmarks of exceptional relationships.
Yeah.
And the reason that's important, the reason I want to note that, is that that the relationships exist on a continuum. And you can have a successful, depends on how we define successful, but you can have a functional relationship, a perfectly functional relationship, and not have it be exceptional.
Yeah.
You can have dysfunctional relationships at the very other end. But an exceptional relationship is one where we both can be ourselves, and where we both, and neither one of us is afraid of what the other one will do with whatever we share with each other. That's one of the hallmarks. Another hallmark is that we can have productive conflict. And in fact, we see conflict as an opportunity to deepen our relationships.
Yeah.
We're both committed to each other's growth. And David, I might have missed a few elements there, but those are the keys.
Where there's high trust that in a sense of what you say is what you mean, that I don't have to second guess you. But let me try to ground it in an example and with Carol and myself. That we started this book, I think, having an exceptional relationship, and the book deepened it. I mean, we've disagreed on a lot of points. There have been things in which we've been upset at each other. But we quickly go to the other and say, I'm really bothered about what you did and what you said, and we got to work this one out. We are concerned about the other person. Carol has a tendency to take on too much, and I repeatedly say, you're going to burn yourself out. Come on, watch out. And I do that not because I just want her around, but I care for Carol, and she cares for me. So I don't to say, do I dare say this? How is she going to feel? Well, I mean, I think about that, but that doesn't mean I necessarily hold myself back. And if I do things that bother her, and I certainly have, Carol's going to say it. So I can relax. I can be myself, and she can be herself.
And
If I might add, one of the most profound moments while we were writing this book was for me, which, and this is quite personal, is that I had always experienced my father, God bless him, may he rest in peace, as being very demanding and as somebody I could never quite please. And I had experienced David that way over the years also. And while we were writing the book, I mean, I'd gotten better because I'd gotten over my projecting my father on David. Otherwise, we couldn't have written a book together in the first place. But there was a moment when we were writing the book where I sent him something and he said, this is good. And I think it could be better. And I found myself thinking, oh, just like with my dad. And then he said, I just know there's so much more there and there's so much more you could say that I want you to be able to say it all. And suddenly my relationship with my father, who's been long gone, shifted for me because I realized that what my dad was saying was not, you're not good enough. What my dad was saying was, you're terrific. And it's not being reflected in what you've just done. So David and I have known each other for over 20 years. We've had a great relationship, and I'm still learning about myself as a result of working with him.
And that sense of not just being committed to each other's growth, but actually, you know, having that relationship where someone's really helping you to you know, expand to your full potential. I think that's
exactly.
Super powerful. Yeah,
exactly.
Love that. And there's a thing in the book where you talk about a time where you didn't have an exceptional relationship. And there's a point where I think, Carol, you said, I don't ever want to talk to David again. So yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, that was before we did the book. We were teaching the course together. And I had been the one that was primarily, there's other faculty who also teach the course, not just Carol and myself. And I was in sort of coordinating the faculty for the course, but was getting close to retiring or getting, I don't use that word, I say I'm never going to retire, getting to emeritus status, replaced me. And we had a kerfuffle around her wanting to have a title, and she felt that I wasn't supporting her. And we really got into a conflict where we didn't understand each other. And for a while, we still work together, but we're more formal with each other. And then we used the principles of the book, and we came back and we said, what's really going on? And I realized that I had heard her rational reasons, but I really hadn't tuned into what was behind him and what her feelings were. And it was only when I said, I still don't agree with what you want, but I think I understand you. And I could accept that that's where she was from, that we could rebuild the relationship. So a key part of what we're talking about is that you don't have to do things perfectly. I mean, we've done things that have screwed up a lot with each other, each of us with our spouse and with our friends and so on. But you can recover. And if you wholeheartedly recover and not just say, well, let's agree to disagree, that doesn't do anything, the relationship gets even stronger. And there's a wonderful image we have in the book, which a friend of mine told me about. There is a type of Japanese pottery, and I've forgotten the formal name.
Kintsugi. Kintsugi.
Kintsugi, good. That when it's broken and you re-glue it, the Japanese fill in the break with gold or silver to hide the break because they say the break makes it more beautiful. And I think that because each of us learned about ourselves and learned more about the other, that was a very painful part. I was really deeply pained because I valued her and I thought I was losing a friendship. So we don't forget about that break. We highlight it. We say, okay, that's what we did. Mm. remember how we got into it and how we got out of it, so that the next time around, the break won't be as big and we can repair it more quickly.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, the last chapter of the book is all about this. And one of the things that I think is really important here is that we, in the writing of that chapter, we got even clearer about what had happened. We had gotten to the point where we were repaired.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we wouldn't have written the book in the first place. But even the talking about what had happened made it clearer, I think, for both of us. And I think a really important point to highlight here that David just said, but I want to underscore it, is that it wasn't until I felt heard and emotionally met that I was prepared to re-enter into this relationship.
Mm. Yeah.
We could talk about it from up here all we wanted, but until I felt met down here,
yeah,
I didn't want to have anything to do with him.
Yeah. I love that, the kintsugi thing. And also, there's something about writing, isn't there, where often, you know, when you write something, it's the process where you crystallize what you really think about it in your head. And that feels really powerful, the fact that you're doing that together and sort of presumably sending the drafts as they get better and better and clearer back between the two of you. That's
yeah. In fact, we wrote every chapter. We probably wrote every chapter 12 times.
Yeah.
Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I've written a couple of books solo, and then I've done two in collaboration as a co-author. And it's funny how when I signed the deal to do those two books as a co-author, I was convincing myself, and my publisher was convincing me, that if you're a co-author, it's half the work. And actually, I think if you're a co-author, it's double the work, isn't it?
That would be my thought.
It's double the work and it's double the outcome.
Yeah.
I figure I could have, if by myself, written 70, 80% of this.
Mm.
Boy, I really needed Carol. Not just so much the content, but to put the nuances on it, to correct my ideas where I may not have been fully clear. And then I corrected her ideas where I thought it was, you know, too general. But I think going back to the process of doing it, one of our colleagues once said, the only mistake you can make is refusing to learn from your mistakes. And I think that's a belief both of us have, and I think is central to the book and to the course.
Yeah.
That we all make mistakes, but they're learning experiences. And if you have that orientation, it allowed us to go back to that very painful time and not raise it again to say, you did something wrong or you really hurt me, but to say, what the hell went on? Why did you off the track? And when you see it as a learning opportunity, mistakes aren't that horrible or that thing to bury under the rug.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go, Carol.
I was going to say, imagine how different organizations would be if that's the orientation most people have.
And I guess this leads us on to, I wanted to talk about one of the hallmarks there that you picked up on a few minutes ago, which is conflict. Mm-hmm. And this idea that, you know, some people see conflict as just like a necessary evil, and sometimes people are going to clash and then we just deal with that and sweep it under the carpet. But actually using conflict and mistakes as a productive thing, as an opportunity, as a growth opportunity. And, you know, maybe you can talk about your own conflict there, but I'd just love to hear more about what you think are some of the elements to make a productive conflict rather than one that ends up becoming toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that I have to hold to the notion that in a conflict situation, I don't have all the answers. Also, I need to hold the notion that I'm dealing with a smart, competent person. I wonder what's going on. What piece of knowledge do they have that I don't have? Also, if we usually get on well, what's going on with our relationship that isn't working out now? That gets me into curiosity.
Yeah.
And rather than saying, you're wrong, this is what you did that's wrong, and if only you were a better human being, which doesn't lead to much productivity. Can I step back and say, yeah, I was really bothered, I'm hurt, I may still be angry, and I'm bothered, but what the devil is going on? Can we learn from it? And can we make sure that not only we've solved this problem, but we've increased our problem-solving ability and know each other better? So I think that's what happened with our conflict, that I got to know Carol better about what was really important to her, and I got to know myself that I at times don't meet somebody emotionally. And that was hard for me to accept, but yeah. Carol told me to it. She said, you know, you tend to go too rational too early. And so I learned something. I wish I had been better in the first place, but you know, life is a process. In fact, sort of to close, when I say life is a process, we have in the book a great quote about Renoir, the great French Impressionist painter. And the story goes, and I think it's true, he lived into his 80s, that his last words as he was dying was, ah, that's the way to do it. And I thought, what a wonderful model of life that I'm constantly learning. Ah, that's the way to do it. And if he lived 4 more years, he probably would have died with the same statement.
Yeah.
And it's not that we arrive. We're in process. All the time we're in process. And can we use that?
I have another example, another conflict example that might illustrate what David was just talking about. So years ago, my husband was learning how to cook. He's now a fabulous chef, but in those days, he was just starting to cook, and he was taking on more and more of those responsibilities. And I came into the kitchen one day, and he looked like he was struggling with something. And I said, "Can I help you with that?" And he looked at me and said, "Don't tell me what to do." And I was a little taken aback, and I thought, I don't know why he's all worked up. And I said, "I wasn't trying to tell you what to do. I was just offering to help." "Well, I don't need any help." So before it escalated into a full-blown conflict, and now I want to bring in a concept that we talk about in the book about two antenna. What's going on for me, my internal antenna, and what signals am I picking up for you, the other person's antenna? And so I stopped, and I thought, wow, I'm feeling hurt, I'm feeling rejected, you know, and I had to first get in touch with what was going on for me, but then I had to get curious about what was going on for him. Gee, I wonder why it's such an affront to offer him help. So I was able to come back and say, "So, honey, what's happening here? What just happened? I offered to help, and I didn't say I didn't think you knew what you were doing." Well, actually, I said, "When you responded, 'Don't tell me what to do,' I didn't think I told you what to do." And he said, "Well, it made me think you didn't know what I was doing." I said, "Okay, well, what's that about?" And we unpacked the fact that he's got some life history of an older brother who lorded it over him and is exceedingly sensitive to not being left to do things on his own so that he can prove that he can do it himself.
Yeah.
Now, I'd lived with this man at that point 20 years, and I didn't know that. So, but before it escalated into a, "Well, God damn it, all I was trying to do was help it. Well, you know, you're always trying to tell me what to do." And before you know, there was something about being in, having these two antenna and using them to not only have a conflict that didn't get out of hand, but also learn something about each other. And I said, you know, the way I show that I love somebody is by offering them to help them, because I didn't get enough of that from my parents.
There's a real...
If I could build on that, because what Carol did, which was wonderful, was to catch it early on. But you don't have to. So here's another confession. Years ago, Eva, my wife, Eva and I got into a conflict. And I got really mad And I went out of the bedroom and I slammed the door. She opened the door. She said, "You come back in here. We aren't finished." And then, so there was a place where it did escalate. And I was ready to storm out because I was felt misunderstood and hurt and wronged and so on. And she forced me back in, thank God. Mm. So you even when it does escalate, you can come back and you can say, "What was that about? You know, what are you doing?"
The book is full of examples, by the way.
Yeah. And what I'm picking up just in the way you both talk about these conflicts is, number one, a real openness, and number two, a real curiosity and commitment to curiosity about yourself as well as about the other person. And so I guess my question based on that is, often the moment of conflict is a moment where you've got two people with, you know, egos on show and their hackles up and the barriers go up. And that feels like a million miles away from the kind of dialogue that you're talking about. So do you have any tips and tricks to sort of de-escalate that moment of conflict to get it back towards where you can have calmer, more logical, more open, curious kind of dialogue?
Well, we do talk about the fact that sometimes you have to take a short break. Sometimes you have to take a breath and say, "You know what? I think we're both a little too spun up right now. Let's take 10 minutes or 20 minutes and, you know, take a breath, but let's commit to coming back." Mm-hmm. That's the key.
Yeah.
That's one way. I don't know, David, you might have some other thoughts here.
No, I think that's crucial. And the break may be 10 minutes. It may be a couple of hours. It may have to be the next morning, but you've got to come back to it and you've got to be committed to coming back to it. I think the other thing is when you were saying, Graham, that your hackles are up and you're feeling defensive, it's back to that other antenna that Carol was talking about, where my tendency is to try and figure out all of the things the other person did that was wrong. Can I, when I'm reflecting, and I may need time by myself, what's going on with me? Why am I so upset? What is, do I not feel heard? Do I not feel appreciated? What's with me? That, because I try not to be defensive, but we all get defensive. You know, what's going on that I got so defensive? And I think that if I can come back to the other person and say, "Hey, I realize there's some issues for me that got in here and I want to share them." Now that requires the other person to both hear me and not to use that against me. So one of the characteristics of an acceptable relationship is the other person won't use information about me against me. So if I go in and I say, "You know, I was really hurt, and this is what it meant for me." If the other person uses that to bludgeon me, it's not going to help in future conflicts. But hopefully the other person will say, "Okay, that helps to de-escalate a little bit." And it's not an easy process. It may take several conversations. But can you stick in there? I think that it's a process of sticking in there.
Yeah.
We have another image in the book. When there's conflict that comes up, we have the image of you're trying to cross a swamp to get to the high ground on the other side. And at first you look for the rocks you can step on so that you don't get mud on your boots. But at some point the rocks run out and there's only some mud ahead of you. Without slinging the mud at the other, it's a messy process. I mean, it's not an easy process. It can be messy. Am I willing to wade a little bit into that mud with the goal of getting to the high ground at the other side? So it's a matter of sticking in there, being persistent, being exploratory, catching yourself, and helping the other person to catch themselves.
Yeah.
The easy process. none of this is easy. Mm. If it was easy, we wouldn't need the book.
Or the course.
Beg pardon?
Or the course. In fact, I think one of the things that students, one of the reasons the course is so, has so much impact, and the reason that we hope the book will, is that it really raises their self-awareness. They start to realize, oh, when people do that or say that, my hackles go up. Mm-hmm. Then they start to understand why. What is it that gets triggered in me? But then the more that happens, the more they have their own heuristics for how to manage it. You know, a version of that is when somebody gives me a really difficult piece of feedback where I feel embarrassed or misunderstood or whatever, and it's really hard for me to hear, the harder it is for me to hear, the more I've learned to think, wow, there must be something really big and important for me here.
Yeah.
So I've trained myself. It didn't happen the first time or the second or the 10th, but it happens enough. And I go back to centering myself in that, wow, there's something important for me here. After a while, I'm able to actually learn and thank the other person as opposed to get defensive and push back.
And you say in the book that feedback is...
I think tie in with that. There's a great statement, maybe apocryphal, but I hope it's true, where the patient asks the therapist, how do I know when I'm cured? And the therapist said, when you catch yourself before I do. And she's still going to have that tendency. And I've seen it.
Yeah.
She catches herself. And that's what self-knowledge is about. It's not about being perfect. We're all human. We're all flawed. It's, can I understand my flaws and accept them and catch myself before they get me into trouble?
Yeah. And you say in the book that feedback is the breakfast of champions.
Right.
So I'm interested if you have any techniques that you use. Obviously, you've got to be open to feedback in the first place, which I think a lot of people... and I put myself in this category, could be more open to feedback. But if you are already open to it, do you have any good tips and tricks for kind of soliciting really good feedback? Because often people are really nervous about how they give you that feedback too, right?
Mm. Well, the feedback model is based on the notion of three realities, not one reality, three realities. One reality is my intention, me. You know, what drives me, my history and stuff like that. The second reality is my behavior, what I actually say, do, the nonverbals, so on. And the third is the impact on you. And each of us only have two of those three realities. I'm an expert about David. Hmm. I know David better than even Carol knows David or even knows David. I know myself and I know my behavior, but I don't know the impact. Carol, in a sense, is an expert on the impact of my behavior. So I need her to understand, does my behavior have the effect that I want it to have? Or does it have some secondary cost that I'm not aware of? That model allows me to be open. It also allows me to... correct when other people don't do it right, because most feedback doesn't stick with that model. So in this, we have a diagram and we have a tennis net between the first and the second reality. And as we say in tennis, you can't play in the other person's back court. In feedback, you can't play in the other person's back court. So if Carol were to say, well, David, the reason why you do X is because... she's over the net. She's in my back court. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know why I do it. And that's what gets me defensive. Yeah. But if she sticks with the impact, I can't argue it. If she says, I don't feel heard, I can't say, no, you don't, because I will over her net. So that model allows me to be open. And most people are over the net. And if they're over the net, you can push them back. So if somebody says to me, well, David, you just want to dominate. Can I hold my defensiveness down and say, wow, that's not my intention, reality number one, but clearly I'm doing something, reality number two, that's making you feel that way. What am I doing? So I'm pushing them back to get the information I need to understand me.
Yeah. Doing that without trying to cross the net.
Yes.
Right. I love that.
And the one thing I'll add is that the more I give you feedback, particularly using the net model and staying on my side of the net, yeah, the more I increase the likelihood that you'll give me feedback.
Mm.
It's a reciprocal process.
Yeah.
Your original question was, how can I get more people to give me feedback? Well, one way is to give them feedback, but yeah, maybe feedback, give it to them in the way that you want to receive it from them.
And is that just down to trust, do you think? Is that because you're just building up that additional psychological safety with each other? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, and here's the hard part. People say, well, I have to trust the other person. And that sees trust as a precondition. I think that the more I take the risk of letting you know me, taking the risk of giving you behavioral feedback, staying on my side of the net, that's what builds trust. So I don't want trust as a precondition. I want to see trust as a benefit that occurs when you stick with this model of feedback.
I love that idea about the more I take the risk of letting you know me. That's a very powerful, idea.
Yep.
It's central to the book.
Yeah.
And you see, what that also does is it actually gives me more control, because if I don't let you know me, you're going to fill in the blanks. Mm. You're going to make stories. And I have no control over the stories you make up.
Yeah.
But I tell you what's going on with me, and hopefully I do it in a way that's authentic and you believe it, you won't have to fill in the blanks. And again, back to curiosity, if somebody does something that I don't understand, rather than my trying to psych them out and fill in the blank, maybe I could just ask them.
Yeah.
You did that. I don't understand that. That doesn't seem like you. What's going on? Is a way that I could avoid making up those stories, which are very likely to be wrong or inadequate, even if partially right.
Mm. I was talking on a webinar a couple of weeks ago about the idea of trust and building psychological safety through empathy. And the whole kind of premise was centered around kindness and the benefits of kindness in team environments and in group environments. And One of the comments that was made in the chat on this webinar was something along the lines of, it's much easier to just be a swear word that I won't repeat on here. It actually takes a lot of time and effort to, you know, to build trust and to give feedback in a really generous way and to work on relationships. Those relationships always need work, right?
Yes.
So I guess that leads me on to asking you about pinches. And it feels to me like there's...
Excuse me, Graham. You said something which I'd like to build on, if you don't
mind.
Yeah,
sure.
When you said it takes time, I don't think it necessarily takes time. So let me tell you a story.
Okay.
I was years ago consulting with a CEO. And we met for the first time. He wanted to get to know me to see whether he wanted to use me, and I wanted to get to know him. And I found that when I went into that building, into the office, there was something funny that was happening to me. I was finding myself being a little careful. So we were talking. We'd been talking for maybe only 20 minutes. So I didn't know him that well. And he said, I don't know what's going on around here. People, in a sense, hold back. They don't say things. They're very careful. I don't know what's going on. And I said, John, I don't know what's going on either. But I got to tell you something. ever since I walked in and talked with the receptionist, and even talking with you, I find myself being very careful about what I'm saying. I don't usually do that. I don't know what the reason is, but I got to tell you, this is happening to me right now. And he sort of leaned back in his chair and he said, "Wow, it's happening to you now?" And I said, "Yeah, I don't know what's going on. I don't think of anything specifically you or anybody has done. But I was listening to my internal antennae. And we then could have a conversation because I took the risk of saying something that he could have said, thank you very much. Now please close the door as you leave. So I don't think it takes time necessarily. Yes, it does take time, but it can be done much more quickly than we think.
Right. Yeah.
If I'm willing to share me and my reaction.
And if I could just add one small thing, which is the more I believe you're going to tell me what's going on for you, really, the more I'm going to trust you.
Yeah. But I suppose all of that, so I suppose it either takes time or it takes a risk, right? So what you're articulating there is like, in that moment, you took a huge risk, which could have derailed your whole reason for being there. And I don't know the outcome, but I'm guessing with a very strong hunch that it didn't derail your reason for being there. And it was, a big light bulb moment too. But I think
here's an example I have a one of the founders that is in my program who was furious because his company had missed a big milestone on a Friday and spent all weekend just worked up about how furious he was. He has a Monday morning all hands meeting and he was all geared up to just blast them all on Monday morning. And Sunday night, he remembered that when we have talked, we've often talked about how anger is sometimes a secondary emotion. And there's usually something even deeper and more fundamental. And he thought, okay, what am I so angry about? Oh, well, I'm worried. I'm worried that nobody else thinks this is as big a deal. I'm disappointed. And so the next morning, instead of coming in and blasting them all, he took a risk and said, hey, gang, I feel really disappointed. And by the way, I'm worried that I'm the only person who sees what a big problem this is. And guess what? Everybody doubled down. And they got that milestone turned around in 2 days when it should have taken them 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So, but he took a risk. He didn't show up in that way that we sometimes think leaders need to show up. He was vulnerable.
And what happens when in situations where it feels like you need to do that, but you're holding back, right? So, you know, there's always those moments in meetings where it's like, oh, I could speak up and I could say something, but maybe we don't have the time or maybe people don't have the headspace for this. So there's all kinds of things that play out in your head. Do you have any thoughts on things that leaders can do to encourage everybody to be more open and to take more risks, or things that you as a leader can do personally to increase that, kind of ability to have the confidence to take the risks?
Well, we're not saying lay it all out. There are times to hold back.
Yeah, right.
There are times where you legitimately ask yourself, should I say this? Is this appropriate? Do we have time to work on it? But the first thing I would say is I would ask myself, am I using this as an excuse? That's the first thing. The second thing I find is that if an idea comes up one time and I say, no, I probably shouldn't. But if it comes up again in my mind, hey, you know, I probably should say this. And if it comes up a third time, then I ought to say it.
Right.
That's something's really going on. And of course, a lot of what we're talking about is how you say it. When people say, well, I'm going to be brutally honest, they're usually more brutal than they are honest. Accusations and accusatory statements and so on. That's not what we're talking about. So you're in a meeting and you think there's an elephant in the room and nobody's talking about it, and you're not sure, you're afraid the messenger is going to get killed for the message. Rather than saying, you bunch of clods, you know, you're avoiding this issue, to say, look, I think there's a big issue here, and it's a little scary for me to raise it, but I think we need to for our sake. Are we avoiding this elephant?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a risk because people may turn on you and say, you know, that's only your issue. That's always a risk. But maybe you get to be known as a person who they can rely on to tell the truth.
Mm.
You're telling the truth not to nail them, but you're telling the truth for the sake of the company, for the sake of this team, and for the sake of the relationship.
Yeah. And I guess the final question before we finish, I sometimes feel like, so I wrote this book, Productivity Ninja, and it's, you know, it's essentially all about how to manage your time and attention well. It's about how to be organized. There's a whole chapter on Inbox Zero and being responsive on email. And I sometimes describe it as like it's a massive rod for my own back. Because now that I have this book and it's like, okay, Graham's the productivity guy, like I better be really productive. Do you feel like over the years you've had that same rod when it comes to relationships? So do you feel like being the relationship people is it sometimes a hindrance? Is it sometimes an annoyance? I'd love to just be slightly playful with the question, but just see if there's a downside to being as good at this stuff as you clearly both are, right?
Well, you know, I did a talk for my Leaders and Tech Fellows a couple of weeks ago where I talked about how embarrassing it was that I had a co-founder breakup with one of the founders that I originally started this with. And we're still wonderful friends and adore each other, but turned out we were not good co-founders. And so I would say that I almost feel burdened. It's like, what? The queen of touchy-feely couldn't figure out how to figure this out? Well, then there's no hope for any of us. And in fact, I'm just as flawed as any other human being. Mm-hmm. And we talk in the book about how it does take two to tango. And every relation, I mean, I put it in the win column that we're still very close and we're still really good friends. I do hold myself to kind of a ridiculous standard on many fronts, not just this one, but probably especially this one.
And to build on that is that it's not only I hold myself, but other people hold me. So
yeah,
there are many times in which I don't do it right. And Eva says to me, you teach this stuff. Why don't you do it right? And of course, yeah. She's right. So I fail. But I'm finding there's another interesting cost that I'm willing to pay. I find meaningful relationships where people talk about what's important to them so rewarding that I don't have patience for the superficial cocktail party stuff. I'm bored by that. I'd rather be by myself, or I'd rather try to take that conversation and drive it deeper. So when I'm in a cocktail party, rather than going around and seeing how many people I can meet, I try somebody who looks a little interesting, and then I ask things about them because I want to find out about them. So I'm able to build the sort of relationship, even if it's temporary, that's more meaningful. But I must say, I'm not the life of the party. I'm not the joke teller. I think I'm funny sometimes. My kids think I'm too. Tell too many puns. But this has a cost in terms of the sort of relationships I don't want to have.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So I'm really excited for people to read the book. I'd love you to just tell us where we can get hold of it and anything else you want to share in terms of how people can connect with you?
Well, I don't know where people can get a hold of it in the UK, but I do know they can order it on Amazon.
Sure.
For sure. And I suspect that it comes out March 3rd. And once after it comes out, then I'm sure it'll be available in all your retail, from many retailers. And our website, www.connectandrelate.com, will have more information on where to buy it. It also has all of the people that have endorsed the book and some little and a link to all kinds of other interesting things. So,
yeah. Oh, can you name drop some names who've endorsed the book? Because there's some really good ones on there.
Sure. Ray Dalio.
Yeah.
Reid Hoffman, who was the founder of LinkedIn. Arianna Huffington. David Roger, who was the founder and CEO of Masterclass. Dara Treseder, who's the CMO of Peloton. Irv Grosbeck, who is the owner of the Boston Celtics, which is a big basketball team here in the United States.
Entrepreneur.
Adam Grant.
Yeah. So there you go. If it's good enough for all of those guys, it's definitely worth getting hold of.
Yeah.
So I just want to say thank you, Carol and David, for being on Beyond Busy. It's been, a huge pleasure. And, I just found that so insightful as well. So just want to say thanks again.
Thank you, Graham. May you have many great, deeper, more meaningful relationships.
Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.